seated. Record in State of Alaska versus John Marvin Jr. This is case number 1HN-10-51. It's the time set for sentencing in this case. Mr. Marvin is here with Mr. Headland, Mr. Brower is here for the state. And Officer Dallas?
Yes.
Is here for probation. Ms. Tokuoka is in the courtroom. Ms. Green, I understand you're on the phone?
I am, sir.
All right. And what about Chief Millen? Is he on the phone?
No, he isn't, Your Honor.
All right.
I would indicate, Your Honor, that Matthew Tokuoka's father, Dean Goodner, is in the courtroom also.
Goodner. Parties ready to proceed?
Yes. Yes.
All right. Just as a kind of a sense of procedure, what I anticipate doing is going through the pre-sentence report here in a minute, seeing if there's any additions, corrections, objections to the pre-sentence report, determining whether there's any evidence the parties wish to present. Then we'll take the sentencing remarks. We'll start with Mr. Brower. Then I have received letters from the Chief and Ms. Tokuoka and Ms. Green. If any of those individuals wish to make further statement, I'll allow them to do that after you speak, Mr. Brower.
Fine.
And then Mr. Headland, we'll have your comments, and then Mr. Marvin. There is a preliminary matter on record before my arrival in the courtroom, but while the clerks and the parties were here, Mr. Marvin was thumbprinted, as required, at a sentencing. And Mr. Headland, I understand that Mr. Marvin has refused to sign the thumbprint form. Is that correct?
I don't know.
All right. Could you come forward, Mr. Headland?
They've already done it. That's why. May have lost it.
Could you ask your client to sign that, please?
I will.
Thank you.
A different one?
No, it's the same one.
Do you not want to sign it?
I'm in.
If you don't want to sign it, just, are you saying you don't want to sign it?
I'm not gonna, it's not accurate.
It's just your thumbprints.
Well, it literally says I'm innocent. Okay. What I'm saying is, it's not accurate.
He's not going to sign it, Judge.
All right. And is it witness, Mr. Mr. Headland? I didn't know.
I wasn't here when it
signed,
but they asked.
And it's signed as witness?
Yes.
And it's Officer Ely. All right.
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Officer Ely, could I ask you to come forward, please? In light of the fact, Officer, would you raise your right hand?
Let me sign in.
Do you solemnly swear a firm testimony about to give me the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
I'm holding in front of me a print verification attachment judgment card. You recognize that form?
Yes, Your Honor.
And there are some thumbprints on there, is that right?
Yes.
And whose thumbprints are those?
Mr. Marvin, Your Honor.
And were those placed there in your presence?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is that your signature at the bottom of the form?
Yes, it is.
Would you print your name below your signature just so we can tell who it is? Thank you, sir. I have received the PSR. Let's see. Pre-sentence reports filed March 19, 2013. I have also received the addendum to the PSR. That also was filed April 13th. That addendum has the letters from Haley Tokuoka, Deborah Green, and John Millen. Ms. Dallas, are there any additions to the pre-sentence report?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Headland, do you have any additions, corrections, objections to the pre-sentence report?
I don't like that the things were relied upon that were done in the context of the competency evaluation in the pre-sentence report. But and the other thing I'll say is that to my consternation, when a case goes to trial and a person's convicted, the author of the pre-sentence report goes back to the original police reports and presents those things as factual when the facts are those that were established during trial. So with those objections noted, I don't have anything else.
No specific objections, apart from the general objections on the makeup of the report.
I think those things should be struck that are from, that were gleaned from any confidential competency evaluations.
Mr. Brower?
Those things, the PSR pre-sentence report is confidential, and that they should stay in there for the court's consideration.
Right.
And I don't see that they need to be taken out.
I'll overrule the objection. Decline to order that they be stricken. Mr. Brower, did you have any objections, corrections, or additions to the pre-sentence report?
No, Your Honor.
Do you have any further evidence to produce, to present, Mr. Brower?
No, I don't.
Mr. Headland, did you anticipate evidence today?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Sentencing remarks, Mr. Brower?
Judge, did you get the sentencing memorandum?
I have received, yes, I should have noted that. I did receive the state sentencing memorandum and have reviewed that.
I don't have a lot to add to that. On August 28th, 2010.
Well, let me also say, Mr. Burr, before you go further, that I've also received notice of filing victim impact statement that was under a second heading, April 4, 2013, and have reviewed that as well.
Okay.
And that was from Mr. Tokuoka's dad.
Right. And I would indicate that they are planning to read those into the record, each of the victims.
All right.
On August 28th, 2010, I guess on August 29th, 2010, Assistant Attorney General Pat Gullifson came by my office on the seventh floor of this building and asked me if I had heard that two Hoonah police officers had been shot. I had been in Hoonah the week before. I had met Tony Wallace. I didn't meet Matthew Tokuoka because he had worked all night and didn't come to the training. And I said, I hadn't heard that. I said, but there are just two police officers in Hoonah. And on the night before it happened, that John Marvin shot and killed both Anthony Wallace and Matthew Tokuoka. In writing the sentencing memorandum, I've asked the court to impose two consecutive 99-year sentences, one for Matthew Tokuoka and one for Tony Wallace. And I've asked the court to impose those sentences regarding Tony Wallace, to impose those sentences separate from the statutory mandate that the jury found Tony Wallace was in uniform and performance of his official duties when he was killed by John Marvin. And as such, the sentence is 99 years with no provisions for either discretionary or mandatory parole. Despite that, I think the court can find that this is a worse offense. John Marvin is a worse offender for committing these crimes, and that the court could sentence John Marvin for the murder of Tony Wallace to 99 years without any chance of discretionary parole. There would not be, if there were no finding by the jury, the court cannot restrict mandatory parole, cannot deduct good time. And the basis for that is it's in the sentencing memorandum that obviously John Marvin knew who Tony Wallace was. He also knew who Matthew Tokuoka was. And when he killed them, he knew they were both Hoonah police officers. When he killed Matthew Tokuoka, it was a few minutes after shooting Tony Wallace. Matthew Tokuoka was a Kahuna police officer, was not in uniform, but he was engaged in official duties at that point. He got on a radio, and as a police officer, he made a transmission to get an EMT ambulance and the chief of police down to the liquor store, Front Street. It's clear that he was engaged in the performance of official duties, and it's clear that John Marvin knew that Matthew Tokuoka was a police officer. And that, as I mentioned in the sentencing memorandum, is based on the fact that Huna is a small town. There were three sworn police officers, and people in Huna knew who they were, but specifically John Marvin knew who Matthew Tokuoka and Tony Wallace were, based on the incident that happened almost precisely a year prior in almost precisely the same place, where Tony Wallace was called to investigate a criminal trespass. When he spoke to the person who made that call, she indicated that she didn't want the case to be investigated in charges. Officer Wallace indicated it was a misdemeanor. He would not be able to arrest anyone at that point. So when he went to talk to Mr. Marvin, and at some point Matthew Tokuoka joined him, Mr. Marvin opened the door, looked at him, and slammed the door. And at some point, they tried to get him to come out. He wouldn't come out. Both officers left the immediate area to determine what to do. They contacted Chief Hankla at the time, and the chief was on his way down there. And while they were waiting, John Marvin came out of his house and attacked both officers. And he did that. And he did that with both officers were armed. I believe it was Officer Tokuoka who ordered him to stop, that he would tase him. He tackled both officers at one point, and he ultimately was tased. And Officer Wallace, who was a wrestler, got him in a hold. And as I think the court saw some pictures of that, he had Mr. Marvin sustained some injuries and both officers sustained injuries. Now, ultimately, those charges were dismissed, but that makes it clear that John Marvin knew exactly what he was doing a year later. The victims in this case lost a son, a father, and in both cases, Tony Wallace has a daughter. And when they were killed, the family, Mrs. Green, Tony Wallace's mother, was in his vehicle talking to Haley Tokuoka and Matthew Tokuoka. Tony Wallace was kind of playing with the kids in the back of Tokuoka's vehicle. And when John Marvin decided that that was the time to kill Tony Wallace, there were two young children very close by who, although they were not physically injured, have this to remember the rest of their lives. And understand from Mrs. Tokuoka they're doing well, but they still miss their father. I'd ask the court to sentence him to find him as a worst offender, and also that this is a worst offense. I don't know of any other case in Alaska where two police officers were ambushed and killed on the same within minutes of each other in any other time in Alaska.
Siege,
in this case, this is a worst offense. John Marvin is a worst offender. The court can find those by the court can make those findings, and he can sentence both John Marvin for the murders of both Anthony Wallace and Matthew Tokuoka to 99 years and to make those sentences consecutive. And I also mentioned in the he was also charged with weapons misconduct for having concealable firearms. Those cases, those charges were dismissed once the verdicts are in for murder, but the court can consider those. Mr. Marvin has no respect for the law, certainly no respect for law enforcement officers. And I think the court can make a finding that in order to protect the public, he should never, ever get out of prison. And a 198-year sentence would ensure that. So that's what I'm asking the court to impose today.
Mr. Burgess, let me ask you one question. Assuming that your characterizations are accurate and the court were to adopt those, and the goal would therefore be to keep Mr. Marvin essentially off the street. At some point, the number of years just stack up so much they become superfluous after a certain amount.
Well,
I'm talking about the composite.
I understand.
Yeah.
There's a case, Hastings versus State, and there's several cases. Hastings, I don't remember his first name, was a person who lived in McCarthy, Alaska, and decided that the pipeline should be shut down, but in order to do that, he'd had to kill everybody in McCarthy to get to the pipeline to shut it down. And he was successful in killing six people and attempting to kill two, and he attempted to kill two others. That he got charged with six counts of murder and two counts of attempted murder. For that, he was sentenced, and attempted murder at that time was a Class A felony. So he was sentenced to six consecutive life terms, 594 years, and the sentencing judge, I can't recall his name, sentenced him to a maximum of 20 years for each of the attempted murders, which was also consecutive. There was an appeal, including a sentence appeal, and the Court of Appeals on appeal affirmed the 594-year sentence but sent back the attempted murder charges because the court did not find an aggravator that would allow the court to impose more than 7 years. And that case languished for some time. In 2007, this was in 1980, I think, two when it started, 1983. In 2007, the Court of Appeals finally got to determine on resentencing. And in fact, it was Judge Bolger, who was now on the Court of Appeals, who did the resentencing. And he did find aggravating factors and sentenced Hastings to the same sentence. He sentenced him to the maximum of 20 years, both consecutive, for a total of 634 years, and that case was appealed. I mean, that case was affirmed on appeal. So I would ask the court, in this case, it's hard in light of some recent things in the news where the Commissioner of Corrections was shot and killed recently. Two officers were killed just yesterday in Mississippi.
Texas. Yeah.
Well, and I think there's more.
Yeah.
Deterrence... Well, in this case, I think the court should focus primarily on isolation and deterrence of others. If people are, the investigation that's going into the murder of the Department of Corrections Commissioner from Colorado indicates that there looks like some kind of a revenge killing for some, perceived things that happened. Deterrence of people who plan on, plan on killing police officers, they know what kind of sentences people get, and they know what kind of sentences they're likely to get if they get caught. So whether that is deterrent or not. But I think reaffirmation of societal norms, I think it's important to let the society know that there is never going to, when you're convicted of these types of crimes, there's not a chance that you're going to be out. And I think it's important in light of the precedence of sentences that have been upheld on appeal, that 198 years is a reasonable sentence in this case. It's a worst offense. Mr. Marvin's a worst offender, and that's what I'm asking the court.
Thank you, Mr. Brower. Mr. Brower, you said that Ms. Tokuoka, you didn't say the names, but I assumed you meant Ms. Tokuoka, Ms. Green, and Mr. Tokuoka's father wished to read their letters.
Right. I think Ms. Tokuoka is going to read hers and Ms. Green's into the record.
All right. Ms. Tokuoka, ma'am, would you like to come up?
She actually would prefer to sit in the witness stand.
I'd rather she stayed over here.
Okay.
Because you should address your comments to me.
Please. Okay. Well, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to read Debbie's letter first.
Ms. Green, is that all right with you if Ms. Tokuoka reads your letter for you?
Yes, sir, it is.
All right.
And she's attached a picture of her and her son. They're very close. She says, Your Honorable Judge George, District Attorney Office, Defense Attorney for John Marvin. First off, let me start off by saying thank you to each and everyone involved in this case. It took over two long years to finally be brought to court. There was a lot of time and effort put into this trial for something that should not have ever happened. As you can see by the picture copied on this letter, that my son and I were so close. We shared a bond that I will never have again, as I was never able to have more, and I will never know what joy there would be to have grandchildren. There is no one left for me, as my family is all gone now. I wanted to say to Mr. Marvin that you have completely destroyed my life. Also, because of death of my son, my mother gave up on life and passed away 6 months after Tony was killed by your hands. Tony was the first grandson for my mother, and he was her proud and joy. You can never understand the depth of my sorrow of not having my son with me. He was everything to me, and you took that away from me and my family. What am I to do now, Mr. Marvin? Live out my life with an empty hole in my heart? Tony lived life to the fullest, and moving to Alaska was a dream come true. For him, not only becoming a police officer, but being able to live in a great state. He loved the town of Hoonah. He enjoyed the hunting and fishing and was so excited to show me where he lived. We only had 3 days together before you took his life. Do you know what terror you put in me that night? Can you put yourself in my place that night? And if it were you, your child lying there bleeding to death, to hold my son as he laid and know that was all the time I had with him. There was so much blood that night. I see it every day. There is no way to remove it from my mind. You also took the life of Matthew Tokuoka, a loving husband and father. To witness not only my son being shot, I had to watch Matt being shot. It has been a nightmare for me, and no amount of pills or I'm sorry can take that away. Why didn't you shoot me? I was there with him and Matt. Why leave me living without my son and my mother? Only you know why you did what you did that night, and I really hope you can live with that. I just want so much to know why. Why would you kill two people who had families and so much to live for? No one deserves to be killed like that. You never think you will outlive your children, and no parent should. So where do I go from here? I know they will be waiting for me when God calls me home. I really hope that you realize what you have done and can find it in your heart to explain to me and Officer Tokuoka widow why you killed them. Wouldn't you want to know if your child was killed like that? Please explain to me. It is not for me to judge you, and I forgive you as God has forgiven me of my sins, because that is what God teaches us. I can forgive, but I will never, never forget that night of August 28th when you completely destroyed my life. My God has mercy on your soul. Sincerely, Debbie Green. I'm going to read mine now. Police officer's prayer. Lord, help us protect the innocent from the evil that men do, and keep us safe as we patrol, for we are the line of blue. May we walk our beats with you by our side, our mission to defend the innocent who count on us to bring in the evil men. For I do not wish to bring them harm, I only wish to serve and bring justice to the lawless men. From my oath I will not swerve. Please forgive me for my sins, dear Lord, should I commit them too. And should I have no choice but to raise my arm, may my aim be straight and true. Lord, watch over our families as we enforce the written laws, and comfort them should I be slain while fighting for the cause. For if I should not make it home, console those that I do love. Let them know I didn't die in vain, and that you're watching from above. And in the end, when the evil get the justice they deserve, may we walk a beat on heaven's tree, for it's you we wish to serve. Paul Bodner. How could your best day become the worst day of your life? August 28th, 2010, our family, also known as the Matthew Tokuoka family, woke up early to go fishing. Beautiful blue skies, flat, calm water, a great family day spent on our new boat, children and music playing as we trolled along the shores of Nika Bay. My husband, Matthew Tokuoka, was so proud to call Alaska his home. New to fishing, he reluctantly tied his lures the evening before, just how my Uncle Reno showed him, only a little rougher around the edges. It didn't matter how his lures looked. They worked. He pulled in 8 cohos along with loaded crab pots. Our son, George, 5 at the time, and our daughter, Layla, 11 months old, had such a wonderful day. They admired their father so much. We would go duck hunting as a family. George and Matthew up front and me with Layla on my back would follow. There is one particular time that I remember. George whispers to his dad, "Dad, Dad, I see a duck." Matthew gets his gun ready and says, "Where, son, where?" George replies, "In your underwear." We laughed about that one forever. As a family, we were always on the go, spending time at our favorite spots, Game Creek, Spasky, clam digging, berry picking, picking Hudson Bay tea, picnicking, and so much more. Every minute Matthew had away from work was spent with us. We didn't need friends. We had each other. He was a dedicated father, husband, police officer, and friend to so many. He served 11 years in the Marine Corps and learned to give his all at everything he did. After pulling in the crab pots, we headed back to town to my parents' house, where Matthew proudly cleaned his fish and cooked his crab. We invited my sister and her family to come and visit and enjoy fresh crab. At about 10:15 p.m., we left my parents' house because Matthew had to be on duty by 11. And on our way, we stopped at the dumpsters to get rid of our scraps due to bear issues. As my children, husband, and I sat in the truck, Officer Wallace pulled up behind us proudly with his mom, so excited to introduce her to my children and I. Matthew had already met her prior and talked to her on the phone often. Debbie considered him her Asian son. From this introduction on, our lives changed forever. One of my best friends, Debbie Green, mother of Anthony Wallace, that night was a stranger to me. Tony stood on the running boards of my truck, leaning in, playing with my daughter and son when a loud gunshot went off. Tony crumbled to the ground. I'm shot, yelled Tony. I'm shot in the head. Immediately, I ran to the protection of my children, and Matthew ran to Tony's rescue, his partner, his friend. I tried to drive off, but Matthew said, "Stop the fucking truck, you're gonna run him over." Matthew drug him from the path of my car, and both officers yelled, "Go, go, fucking go." Matthew drug Tony behind the patrol car, apparently still in the line of fire. I sped home screaming and yelling at the top of my lungs. I left the kids in the car, ran straight into my mom and dad's house where we had just left, and told my mom to get the kids from the truck while I dialed 911 to hear Debbie's voice say, "Second officer down." Matthew was shot twice in the chest and now lie with Tony in the arms of Debbie. I told my family not to leave the house, stay inside and load a gun. I took a loaded gun with me and headed down to the scene, but decided not to go there. What if Matthew was fatally wounded? I could be shot, or I could go to jail for killing John Marvin. I knew at this point my children desperately needed me. I went to the police station to find out where the officers were. They were being loaded up in the back of a pickup truck and transported to the Hoonah Clinic. When I arrived at the clinic, people arrived to comfort Debbie and I. But Bernard Wolf unloaded my gun for me. My proud husband now lied on a cot quietly as Tony screamed, "Where's my mom? Where's my mom?" Debbie replied, "I'm right here, Tony. I can't get any closer." Everyone tried to calm him down, but he hysterically fought for his life. Matthew, unable to speak because his chest and stomach were filling with blood, mouthed to me, "I love you." I told him that I loved him so much and everything was going to be okay. I told him that the children and I were fine and that I would make sure to take care of them. His blood pressure began to fall along with his heart rate. They tried to revive him several times, however, nothing worked. Chris Budke sat with me pumping oxygen, telling me that he wouldn't stop until I wanted him to. I asked him if it was time, and he said yes. So he said a prayer, and Matthew died peacefully as I sang to him. Tony lay in the cot as the medical crew got him ready to be transported by Coast Guard and looked back at me and said, "I'm sorry. I will never know what that meant, because Tony also died in transport. Two very important people who both my children and I looked up to were taken from our lives. I wanted to march right down to John Marvin's and kill him. I wanted him to die a slow death, brutal, painful, burn in hell. Oh, no, I didn't want to shoot him. That's the easy way out. I wanted him to end up in jail where he would be beat, molested, raped, and die in prison. Tony was a great friend to our family and often came to our house to visit and play with our children, attended birthday parties and family dinners, as well as went on hunting trips. Matthew and Tony were inseparable. Where one went, the other was sure to follow. My brother-in-law, Paul, and my nephew, Paul, in particular, had a great relationship with Tony, too. Tony was a big brother, and they often went hunting and fishing together, but their passion for wrestling was what they shared most in common. He would attend practice with him, or he would come over to my sister and Paul's house and help him by teaching him new moves. Tony was kind enough to get signed gloves from his friend, UFC fighter Matt Hamill, who is also deaf, and surprised Paul with them. On this night, my nephew Paul heard a gunshot and went out on the deck to check what was going on, and what he saw will haunt him forever. He witnessed his uncle Matt dragging Tony and then heard other shots to follow. He lost his uncle and one of his life mentors. I never thought I would be a widow with two small children at the age of 30. But the most disturbing thing to me is how could and why did John Marvin do this in front of a mother, wife, and especially two small children, the bullet just inches away from them. Loud noises now and will always be a fear to them. John Marvin, only you know why you did this. Revenge, Mr. Marvin, revenge. I want you to know that you took away the most amazing person in my life, my husband, my friend, and the most amazing father. My children, only five and not even one at the time, have to live their lives without their father. Holidays and birthdays are hard because we don't get to experience all this with Matthew. You took away so much from us and left us wounded and scarred for life, a nightmare we live daily and forever. I will never forget the night of August 28th, but I will not let that night ruin the beautiful day we had on August 28th. I will not let you ruin my life or the life of my children. We may be scarred for life, but we stand strong and continue to press on and remember the true heroic person Matthew Tokuoka was. He was always our hero, only now everyone sees the hero he truly was. Debbie Green and I weren't able to start our friendship off on a good note. The night we met, we saw our loved ones die. But we too stand together and keep each other strong and will always be friends forever. The whole community of Huna were victims to this crime and to this day are still affected. The entire town was on lockdown for 2 days while you cowardly barricaded yourself in your home. The community was in shock that a crime of this magnitude could take place in a quaint little town. Emotionally, so many people were affected. Arlen Scaffelstead and Owen James, first on the scene, loaded the officers up in Mr. Scaffelstead's truck. EMT, firefighters, PAs, health aides, etc., people from villages and others from out of town set up perimeters around your house until the SWAT team arrived. Families were separated. Friendships have been ruined. Culturally, you killed your grandmother, Mary Wilson's Yake Shawat husband. A funeral was held and broadcasted nationally. The gym was packed with others watching in other areas because there was no room. The governor attended along with the Marine Corps. A beautiful service for two beautiful men. People and other officers came from all over the world to pay their respects. I'm sure you feel like you accomplished something, but as you sit in your cell alone for the rest of your life, ask yourself, was it worth it? John Marvin, you met Honorable Judge George and the jury, but let me tell you, you still have to answer to our Maker, Jesus Christ Almighty, the ultimate judge, who says we must forgive. I forgive you, John Marvin, but I will never forget, and I hope that Jesus can forgive you too. Even though Matthew was not dressed in his uniform the evening of August 28, 2010, I believe that Mr. Marvin specifically shot both officers intentionally. You could have killed so many people that night, John, but you had revenge on Anthony Wallace and Matthew Tokuoka. I believe that you should receive the same sentence as you received for Anthony Wallace, a mandatory sentence of 99 years. And I just want to thank everybody else, Judge, everybody who's been involved, and, the Juneau Police Department has been amazing, the people of Hoonah. There's just been so many people who have been so supportive, and I just want to thank everybody, and thank you.
And Mr. Goodner, there you are, sir.
My name is Dean Goodner. I'm Matthew Tokuoka's father. I'm here today to read an impact statement. Our family has taken this opportunity to thank the state of Alaska and Alaska state officials for the apprehension and conviction of John Marvin. We thank both the state of Alaska and Alaska state officials for the respect, concern, empathy, and financial support they have shown in the preparation and execution of funeral service for the two slain Alaska police officers, Matthew Tokuoka and Anthony Wallace. We appreciate the attendance of the governor of Alaska, the police representatives who came from all over Alaska, United States Marine Corps representatives, the representatives of Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the bagpipe players, and all the others who took the time and effort to attend the funeral service for our son, Matthew Tokuoka, and his police partner and fellow police officer, Anthony Wallace. We thank them for providing the transportation for all those mentioned and attending to the myriad of details that accompany an effort this large, all completed with dispatch and efficiency when all those mentioned had a full schedule. We thank the extended stay hotel located in Juneau, Alaska, for providing our housing, and budget car rental for providing transportation for us at no cost. We thank Scott Harmon and his buddies at Horizon Air for donating their guest buddy airline passages, helping defray the cost of attending Matthew's funeral service for Matthew's family. We thank the city of Hoonah for their part in all that mentioned above. In addition, we thank the city of Hoonah for their assistance in providing answers from the beginning of this tragedy and their support after the funeral provided by both the police department and the city administration department. We thank Hoonah as a city, local businesses, and Hoonah individuals that offered and provided more assistance than we could accept or use. Thank Haley Martin's large extended family for the warmth and hospitality they provided. All those Alaskans who assisted our family exemplify what it means to be great humans, Alaskans, and Americans. The family impact here is that five little children, four of Matthew's and one of Tony's, have lost the physical presence of a dad they could count on to protect them, financially support them, encourage them throughout their lives. They lost their dad to wake up to, a dad to watch their ball games, a dad to teach them to hunt, fish, play sports, and be a mentor in all things throughout their lives. These children lost a dad they know is admired by both the community they served and their own immediate and extended families. Kids, young or old, have their confidence and self-esteem built in part by how others perceive their parents. All these children have lost that facet of their psychological growth. Matthew's sisters, Jenny, Becky, and Casey, all lost a brother they admired and loved, the brother they could count on as only siblings can. They lost a brother as a confidant, a brother to show off to admire, and be admired. Matthew's parents lost a son they loved as only parents can unconditionally love. They lost a son they saw grow through all the challenges of infancy, childhood, and eventually adulthood. They lost a son who they admired for all his accomplishments and all that having a son means. The financial impact on Matthew's growing family is significant. At a median wage for Matthew, between the time of his murder and Matthew's normal retirement age, Matthew would have earned more than $1.5 million. In addition, Matthew's immediate family not having his monthly income, not only lose that income, but also the additional income his then current real estate investment would have provided in the future. Matthew's family enjoyed a dual income lifestyle. Now there's only one breadwinner, and the cost to his household actually increases. The cost increases as domestic repairs occur, a paid sitter is required for the young children at times, etc. The cost of running the household is generally static. When the recurring expenses are paid, the remainder provides a disposable income, which relates in large part to a certain standard of living, financial security, and stability. Totally erase one whole income from a dual-income family, and most times even the current expenses cannot be paid. The result many times is that the surviving family members can live a better life on public assistance than on a single income. Public assistance too many times creates a downward spiral in self-respect, self-esteem, and increases criminal behavior for all involved. Gang membership, teenage pregnancies, drug, alcohol, and other social ills increase significantly for the children of a family on public assistance. Marvin, I'm here today to address the court, not Marvin. I respect the court's unique position in attempting to balance justice with state laws and balance competing interests from the murdered officers' families, law enforcement, and Alaskan Natives. My purpose in addressing the court today is to speak for those who now cannot speak for themselves. My attempt to help the court see the devastation Martin has left in his wake, which will endure for how many generations? The slain officers' families will endure at whatever level they will, but they will never be whole again. And for what? Marvin, for the record, is not and has not ever been a productive citizen. Marvin is not someone any Alaskan could be proud of at any level. Marvin has preyed upon others his entire life. Marvin was convicted of sexually molesting a 5-year-old girl for 4 years. Marvin physically abused his wife, being arrested twice for those actions. Marvin was not, as some have said, a good seal hunter, a good shot. Instead, he cowardly ambushed and shot for center mass, two unsuspecting human beings, and left them to die in agony for hours under the best available medical care. There are many issues I have with Marvin. I do not have enough respect for him in any manner to address him personally. I ask the court to place Marvin in regular federal prison for the maximum amount of time allowed, which is 2 99-year prison sentences with no chance of parole. I believe Marvin should be sent to a regular federal prison for the rest of his life, not to a prison for the mentally ill where he can be kept secure, comfortable, fed, housed, and under control with drugs while the survivors of his rampage will have to struggle for food, housing, and financial security for the rest of their lives. Marvin should have to do his prison time with the type of murderers and child molesters he is. I've intentionally kept my statements rather short and terse, as I'm not capable of expressing the breadth of feelings I have for 40 years of raising a child to successful adulthood, to see that child's life cut short and his family destroyed in so many ways, for an instant of immediate self-gratification, rage, or whatever perverted excuse Marvin or his defense attorney raised. And for the record, it's my opinion that Haley Tolkoak's claim against the city of Hoonah should be dismissed with prejudice, as is Marvin's actions that deprived Haley of all that she is being deprived of, not the city of Hoonah, Alaska, or its residents who have been incredibly supportive of Haley and her children in every way they could. Oh, I have, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Mr. Hedlund?
I think everybody knows that the realities the court alluded to, the length of sentence that is mandated in that ultimately we're talking about what are, in reality, superfluous amounts of jail time that would require somebody to live longer than any human being has ever lived to serve. At the outset, I must, on Mr. Marvin's behalf, say that my comments are made in light of the jury verdicts, but that he maintains his innocence. The and also related to the first point, it's not clear that much of what I will say matters in terms of the practical sentencing guidelines at law that the court employs here, based upon the murder one convictions. The, you know, we, the trial was emotional, and of course Ms. Tokuoka talking reminds us all of the trial and the way it was, and it was, for me, a unique experience. I mean, literally, the officer's family were 2 feet behind me. I could hear them talk. I could hear them comment on what I was saying or doing during trial. It was, it would see them socially outside of court. It was surreal. And everybody was, you know, for the large part, very friendly. I was surprised at how friendly people were toward me, for the most part. And I appreciated that. But to say that people didn't, on some level, collectively understand that this isn't something that had to happen, that I don't think would be accurate. I mean, my sense is that even Ms. Tokuoka, even Ms. Green, everybody felt on some level that this is something that you didn't really, that maybe could have been avoided. And when Mr. Brower argues in his sentencing memorandum that this incident was without provocation, I mean, there's some literal, I suppose, ways to argue that. But I'm not sure that anybody really believes that that's exactly right. I mean, Ms. Tokuoka's own lawsuit alleges that Officer Wallace was antagonizing Mr. Marvin. Nobody disputes that there was the incident a year before, and that although Mr. Brower, you know, said everybody had injuries, that Mr. Marvin suffered the brunt of those injuries and was beat up pretty good. And the jury didn't hear it, but there was audio of that incident that we were all privy to. And, you know, the police surrounded Mr. Marvin's house, and they
need some headphones.
Oh, okay.
Testing, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, testing.
I can't remember.
1, 2.
Nobody
one,
saw
two.
Anything.
Okay.
I'm not any question.
I got it.
They ain't question. Nobody saw anything.
1, 2. 1, 2.
And then it's illegal to have the other case still open. One disclosure, so
you're going to get the talk when I'm done. Huh. Is that what it'll be?